Chapter 10. A Thing That Had to Be Done. Brother Anselm closed his breviary. He had finished the office for the day in his cell, an unforeseen occurrence having prevented him attending choir with the other monks. After the major's departure, the cripple had said something about not feeling well. Brother Anselm had taken him back to bed, and then, for an hour or more, he had watched him through an agony of stabbing, torturing pain. Throughout, no word of complaint had escaped his lips. Brother Anselm had noticed his eyes resting at times on the crucifix hanging on the wall. When the attack had passed, the cripple had lain quiet for a little, and then asked him a curiously direct question. Supposing you were in my position, supposing you knew that you had to lie on your back for the rest of your days, cut off from the pleasures of life, and having at times to suffer pain like this, how exactly would you take it? Brother Anselm had looked at the youthful face all drawn and white, and then through the window into the distance where the sun was sinking into long lines of purple before he answered. How would I take it? I would take it as an honor to be chosen for the royal road of pain, and I would take it as a privilege to be asked to share so fully the cross with Christ. And the cripple had just said, "Thank you." He was now in a sleep of sheer exhaustion. Brother Anselm laid his breviary on the table. He rested his chin on his hand and looked out into the night. The evening star had not yet set. It hung there, twinkling, crystalled in the deepening blue. His mind turned to the events of the afternoon. He could feel no regret for what he had said to the atheist. It might have some effect, it might have none. In the latter case, and if he gave further trouble, there was only one way left of bringing him to shame, to that shame of himself without which he would never change. Yes, one way was left. He was thankful now that the other had not remembered him as Doctor of the Battery, thankful too that he had never found out who had saved his life, for the other's ignorance left him in possession of a powerful moral weapon to use if necessary. Much, though, he disliked the idea of using it at all. As he looked out into the peace of the night, another night recalled itself. A night at the front. A night of horrors. The night on which he had saved the atheist's life. The vivid memory of it all came back. They were retreating. Had been retreating for 2 days. An order had come through on the second afternoon. Their guns were to hold a section of the line unless compelled to retire. The enemy had broken through 2 miles ahead. He could see the major now, standing there with a GHQ chit in his hands, looking grave as he folded it, and remarking, "That means hell. Get to work, Captain." And to himself, "Doc, you'd better stay here. You'll be wanted soon." For an hour or so their guns were letting loose, until he was nearly deaf from the incessant roaring bark. Once the major had come back to the dugout. "Won't be long now, Doc. They'll pay this back double." It was his signal. As he climbed up into the open, there came the slow, steady whistle of a delay fuse. Crump! Dead on their line. Then those guns 6 miles away got to work. The major was right. It was going to be hell. The relentless shells crashed unceasingly, mercilessly, shaking the ground under his feet with their cavernous thunder, flinging up sods by the ton. 2 direct gun hits, and his own work began. Those mangled heaps that had been men did not need attention. They were silenced like their guns. He told the dead at a glance. The wounded took all his time. Once something red-hot seemed to be drawn across his forehead. A bit of shell had grazed him. He ignored it until the blood ran down into his eyes, then told the man whose leg he was bandaging to do the same for his own head. He went on in a sort of mechanical way, patching them up one by one, vaguely aware that his work was more or less futile, for the wounded themselves were being killed off now. The stretcher-bearers were doing their utmost, but it was impossible to cope with the havoc of this cruel barrage. The air was thick with the smell of smoke and blood. He wondered when the major would give the order to retire. They would be wiped out before long. It was getting dark, too. The flaming explosions were now lighting up the white, staring faces of the gunners. They were working the guns still in action, in a sort of mad, hopeless way, listening amidst the din, like himself, for the word that meant release. It came at last. That order. Then the clanking of harness and the drivers cursing their horses up the hill, guns being hitched and pulled off at a gallop, the tattered remnant of gunners hurriedly following, nervous to leave the hell spot. The Major remained there, peering about him.
"Seen the captain, Doc?"
No, he had not. But suppose he was with the gunners. The other seemed satisfied. He saw the rest of the wounded taken away, then joined the Major. They lit a cigarette each, took a last look at that scene of devastation, and made their way down to the wagon lines. There the Major received another order from GHQ. They were to retire to a position 4 miles back. Their infantry lines had been broken through again. The enemy was only a mile away. The Major was asking for the captain. He could not be found.
"Seen him yet, Doc?"
"No, not a sign," he had replied. "They must clear off anyway," said the Major, and he went to attend to the guns and wagons. A gunner came up. Could he speak to the doctor? He had seen the captain knocked out close to his own gun. His leg was broken, he believed, though he had been taken to the dressing station. Brother Anselm remembered those next few minutes very clearly. He suddenly understood. He knew quite well that the captain had not been taken to the dressing station, that he must have been overlooked and left up there amongst the horrors of that death trap. He walked away from the shouting and noise of the battery preparing to start, and in the darkness strained his eyes to make out their recent position. Yes, he could see the rise of the hill, the lurid glare of shell bursts revealing it in black outline. The captain was there, somewhere. He paced about in an agony of indecision. There was no obligation upon him to do it. Why should he? Why should he try to save a man against whose vile, lying ways his whole being revolted, merely to give him further opportunities? He had discovered his evil influence in the battery already, and the captain had only been a few weeks with them. They had scarcely crossed each other's paths, for his work as medical officer took him away from the mess for most of the day. But he had heard sufficient to know that all the captain's spare time was spent in trying to instill unbelief and even malice against God into others. He had a way with him, it seemed, that made them listen. No, he couldn't. Oh, why that man of all men? But left there to die like a dog with all that infamy upon him? Could he? He couldn't leave him like that. Suddenly he knew he would do it. He found his batman holding his horse ready. The battery was on the point of starting. He ascertained from another officer their next position. Then, after swinging himself into the saddle, he leaned down to his batman. Tell the Major I'll get there on my own, see? The batman saluted and disappeared. He dug with his heels and rode out of the turmoil, round to the right, as if going on in advance. As soon as the darkness hid him from sight, he wheeled his horse round.
No, you don't.
And he dug at its sides until the unwilling beast plunged forward and then sidled along the road, whinnying to its companions in the dark.
Shut up! Sorry, my beauty, but it's got to be done. Come on.
He patted the horse's neck and urged it into a canter. His eyes were growing used to the dark, and the whites of the road made going fairly easy. After half a mile, he pulled up, searching for the track up the hill to the left. He found it. The hard clatter of the road changed to the squelch of mud.
Quietly. Don't put us down.
Halfway up, he dismounted. Shells were dropping again, and there were too many holes. He led his horse carefully until they reached the top. There he halted and took his bearings. On the right, a quarter of a mile away, he could just see the line of the road running over the hill. There were figures against the horizon hurrying along. Their infantry, he guessed. Fritz must be pretty close. Now, which was his way? That was the line of dugouts. Where had the guns? This one was coming a bit too...
Steady now! A blinding flash. The ground heaved up with a deafening roar. He felt himself almost lifted, and then flung down, half buried in mud and sods, choking to get his breath.
He waited, then gradually freed himself and struggled to his feet, dazed and shaking. It was all blinding smoke. His horse? That dark bulk lying there? He slowly perceived what had happened. The horse had taken the shell, blast and all, and saved him. It was dead. He looked at it with a pang. His hand was dripping, running with blood. It was from his arm. He took off his tunic, found some bandages in the pocket, and with teeth and fingers bound up the wound. It was a nasty gash. He succeeded in nearly staying the flow.
Now get on with it.
Where had those guns been? Another shell burst lit up the scene for a second and gave him a glimpse of gun wreckage 100 yards ahead. He went forward carefully, avoiding shell holes, and reached what had been their gun line. It'd be somewhere along here. He put his hands to his mouth, shouted the captain's name, and listened. An eerie silence followed. He tried again. Only the wind answered, sweeping over the ridge to mock his effort. He would have to search then amongst the dead. Gruesome job, but it had to be done. He began at the far end, picking his way among them, some with faces turned to heaven, some to earth, looking closely for three stars on the shoulder strap. He came to a group of three lying close to a twisted gunwheel. As he bent down, his doctor's intuition told him that the one in the middle was not a corpse. There were three stars on the shoulder strap. He struck a match. A gust of wind blew it out, but not before he had recognized the captain. The cynical twist of the mouth was what he had seen. It was enough. He was alive, but unconscious, evidently from loss of blood. The left leg was broken and the putti still oozing warmly. That must be stopped. He wound his remaining bandages round tightly above the wet part. The captain began to mutter unintelligibly and then lapsed again into unconsciousness. If he had had his horse, he could have managed fairly well then. It would be no easy matter carrying this helpless man over the shell-riddled ground. The strain of the last few hours, combined with his recent experience and loss of blood, was beginning to tell on him. But it had to be done. About 400 yards, he guessed, it would be to the nearest point of the road, keeping along the ridge. He knelt and hauled the captain's body onto his back, with his arms dangling over his shoulders. Then, gripping in the wrists, struggled to his feet and started. He got clear of the wreckage and corpses. He wished those shells would stop. They were landing now between him and the road. They didn't matter to himself. He had got to a stage when nothing seemed to matter. But he had to get the captain back. He staggered on. He must be halfway. They were bursting close now. Clods of earth were hitting him. He set his teeth. His head began to feel funny. Silly. Everything seemed to be aiming at him. There were lights dancing. Don't be a fool. Get on with it, man. It had to be done. With a fierce effort of will, he went on. Then he began to lurch about. The captain was getting heavier. The ground was coming at him. He regained consciousness to find himself and the captain lying in a shell hole. With great difficulty, he sat up, dizzy and sick, vaguely realizing that he had collapsed. He was played out. His forehead and arm were both bleeding again. He tried to stand, but his head whizzed and he sank back in a stupid, feeble way. The captain was talking deliriously to himself, roused by the shock of the fall. He pulled himself into an easier position, lay still to recover a little, and then, dragging himself up painfully on hands and knees, managed to crawl over to the edge of the shell hole. The moon was coming up above the line of the ridge, revealing the hideous desolation all around, cavities and tree stumps standing out blackly against the pale light. There was something white nearby. Was it? Yes, it was the road. He had nearly done it then. He followed the white track with aching eyes. It was empty now of those hurrying figures. No, it was not. There were some men scurrying along, only 100 yards away. He shouted. The sharp whistle of a shell came, and he saw them crouching for the burst. Then two more. They were running to get out of range. They had not heard him. He watched their figures recede into the distance and disappear. A sense of helplessness came upon him. He searched the road again. Not a soul in sight. Only those ghostly tree stumps everywhere. He looked down at the captain lying there. A thought came to him. Without that burden... You blackguard! You blackguard! No, you don't! You get back with him, or you don't get back at all! He was too weak now to carry the captain a yard further. He could only watch the road for any help that might appear. The feeling of isolation increased. Not a living being about. Nothing but death here. Dead stumps, dead bodies... Dead. Something arrested his eyes. Curious, he hadn't seen it before. Close behind the shell hole stood a great, gaunt crucifix, the Christ hanging pale and vivid in the moonlight. With an effort, he stood up and saluted. He noticed that it was untouched by shells, one of the many wayside shrines that had escaped. Something struck him about the figure. The half-closed eyes of the crucified seemed to be looking down into the shell hole at the man who was lying there, at the man who was his enemy. He stood there, spellbound by what he saw in that moonlit Christ stretched there amidst the terrors of the ridge. for it had come to him that someone had suffered immeasurably more than himself. Yes, infinitely more, for that mocking unbeliever below. He went and laid his blood-stained head against the wounded feet.
"Hello there. Do you want to get cut off?"
He turned round with a start to see a limber cart drawn up on the road. He called back loudly. Someone was springing down, running across to him. He went forward.
"Spotted you from the road. What's up?"
The voice was familiar. As its owner came close, he recognized him for an officer of their own infantry.
"Why, it's not..."
"Yes, it is. Doc, what are you doing here?"
He pointed down the shell hole.
"Help me get him back, will you?"
The other took in the situation at a glance and shouted to the driver of the limber cart, who jumped down and hurried over to them.
"Go and talk to the horses, Doc, will you? We've just come through Hades. We'll bring him along. You're done in. Here, have a pull at this."
5 minutes later, they were going down the road at a gallop, the captain propped up against them on the floor of the cart. Half an hour, and they were at the dressing station. The orderlies on duty carried the captain inside. An M.O. came and looked at him. He was taken, still unconscious, into the examining room. As the infantry officer clambered back onto the limber cart, he said to him,
"Thank you for the good turn. Will you do me another?"
"What's that?"
"Forget about finding me with him up there."
The other had been guessing things on the way back. He understood. There was an immense admiration in his eyes as he replied,
"If you really want me to, yes. But Doc..."
"Oh, Doc, you're great. Cheerio!"
And the limber cart passed into the night. He went back into the hut to have his own wounds attended to. The M.O. recognized him, commented on the mud and blood, but asked no questions. The captain, he found, was to be taken down immediately to the CCS. His own case was not so serious. Flesh wounds and loss of blood. He would wait and go down in the morning. When he reached the clearing station next day, he found it was not the one to which the captain had been taken. On the whole, he was glad. It saved explanations. 4 weeks later, he had rejoined his battery, fit again. To his surprise, the major had guessed the truth about his disappearance. The man who had seen the captain knocked out had also seen himself riding off towards the ridge. He informed the major of both facts. The major had also learned of his arrival with the captain at the dressing station.
"Doc," he challenged him, "look me in the face and say you didn't go and get him. You saved his life. You're blushing about it like a 2-year-old.
He had admitted it, but refused to give more than the barest outline of what he had gone through that night. Then he had bound the major by a solemn promise to tell no one. The major had given his promise very reluctantly. The captain, he learned later, had recovered to be stationed at home for the rest of the war. They had never met again until the night of the accident, and the other had forgotten him and had not found out. The clock in the tower struck midnight. Brother Anselm started, to find himself staring into the night. He sighed. Memory slipped away into the past once more. He stood up slowly. Then he went out of his cell, down the corridor, and had a last look at the cripple. He was sleeping peacefully. Down at the hotel, another man also looked out of his window into the night. It was the atheist. He was thinking about the monk. His eyes were gleaming with hatred.